this harassment?
Laura asked Henry to get Kelly to ring her as soon as she woke, so I guess we can only wait. He rolled his eyes. And now the press are everywhere. Marie sighed.
I ran the gauntlet coming through the gates.
Ruth has already gone down and made one of her famous statements that managed to say just about nothing. But there's a press conference booked for later this afternoon, Jackman grimaced. And she wants me there.
Inevitable, I guess.
You always hope they'll hold off for as long as possible, don't you?
They get in the way, not to mention muddying the waters by stirring up the public.
Marie was no fan of the media, but then none of them were.
Mind if I pop down to see Orak, sir? I know she won't have anything yet, but I thought I'd make sure she knows that Henry Arnott could do with a bit of special attention.
He nodded. Certainly. And ask her to add the name Alfie Brown to those with links to the victims.
Is that the man Robbie's gone to see?
He's our only hope at present. I hate to pin too much on him, but he's all we've got.
Watching him stride back to his office, Marie could sense his frustration. It was coming off him in waves. A young man's life was in jeopardy, but they had no idea where to find him. She descended the stairs to the basement with a heavy heart.
Marie, don't tell me you have more for me.
Orla gave her a look of mock horror. Just two names, Orak. One you already have, but we'd like you to pay particular attention to him, Henry Arnott. And a new name, Alfie Brown.
And what part do we think Mr. Brown plays in this drama? Asked Orak.
That of the next victim, or so he believes. He knows all the other victims and has been exploring with all of them. That is a first. We are interviewing him now. Jackman believes he could be the link that will lead us to the identity of the killer.
Well, at least he's still alive, remarked Orak.
You can talk to him and maybe hit upon what's driving this murderer. She took the memo from Marie. I'll certainly see what I can find out from here.
Marie turned to go.
It was good to have Orak back. She made you feel safe.
She turned back.
Orak, when this important stuff is out of the way, could you check out anything you can find about an old airfield at Randleby, near Fenchester? I want to know who owns the land and who is responsible for it. It seems that anyone who asks questions about the place gets warned off.
Orak frowned.
But wasn't that one of the places you listed as being the site of a disappearance? Aaron Smith was taken from there, as I recall.
It is. Well, Marie, the good thing about computers is that they have an infinite capacity for multitasking. I'll start searching now, and we'll see what comes back. I'll ring you.
Marie thanked her and left.
Orak seemed to be back to her old self. One less thing for Marie to worry about. It dawned on her that if it wasn't for this horrendous case, her life was looking pretty good. Her old nemesis had been put away for life, and a very attractive man had asked her out. Added to that, Orak was home again. Jackman was settled with Laura, and Max had turned into Dad of the Year. If Gary were to meet someone and Robbie get a little more settled, life would be just about perfect. She realized it was the first time in years that she had felt this way. Her grief at losing her husband so young had left her emotionally numb. She would never forget him. Not a day would pass when she didn't think of him. But suddenly it felt as though the shadows were lifting. She wandered into the CID room, to be met by an anxious-looking Gary.
I've been puzzling over that bloody airfield, Sarge, and wondering how come someone knew you were going there. After all, it was only John, Ralph, you and me that talked about it, wasn't it? How come you were met by a welcoming party?
I've been wondering that myself, she said, but the boss wants us to shelve that for the time being and concentrate on young Crazy Hazy.
Oh, I totally agree, he's our priority, but it's been nagging away in the back of my mind.
They heard Robbie's desk phone ringing.
I'll take that, said Marie, and hurried over.
Stella sounded pretty hyped up. Marie grabbed a pen and a memo pad.
Say that again, Stella. The P house. Where's that?
A few moments later, she was hanging up and running to Jackman's office.
Boss, Stella has something for us. An abandoned warehouse that wasn't on the list. She's absolutely sure no one has checked it, and she just had a message on her Facebook site that has registered alarm bells. The mother of one of her UE friends lost her dog, and she's been out looking for it. She heard the noise of whining from inside the old warehouse but can't get in.
Her son, who's away, posted an SOS to Stella to see if any UEs were in the vicinity and could help her get inside.
Oh, my. Where is this place?
Stella's given me directions. It's out on an area of farmland that stretches down to the river near Updike, about 6 or 7 miles outside Salton. She looked at him eagerly. Shall I notify Uniform?
See if anyone's in the area. But you and I need to go. It could turn out to be the lost dog. But what if... He was already on his feet. We'll take my car. Come on.
He didn't need to ask Marie if she was as keyed up as he was.
If it is him, I pray we get there in time.
Uniform are sending a car. ETA around 10 minutes. Marie looked at her watch, then raised an eyebrow. But at the speed you're driving, we should get there first.
What do we know about the pea house? He asked.
I just googled it. Updike used to be a thriving community surrounded by pea-growing farms. It was a factory where they sorted and packed peas for export. It fell into disuse years back since different crops are grown there now. It's completely abandoned.
Just the sort of place the magician would like.
He put his foot down. They arrived a few minutes later and were met by a distraught-looking woman in walking boots, jeans and a Berghaus jacket.
I only wanted one of my boy's friends to help me. I never meant for the police to be called, honestly.
Jackman held up his hands. It's fine. You're not in trouble, okay? It was our decision to come. Now, what's your name?
Pauline Seabrook, sir.
Okay. Now, tell me what you heard.
Whimpering, sir. Whining. It has to be my Iggy. He's a right terror. He's a Jack Russell. And it's not the first time he's got in somewhere and couldn't get out. She paused. But the sound stopped about 15 minutes ago, and now I'm really worried.
No more than I am, thought Jackman. Okay, Marie, let's find a way in. You stay here, Mrs. Seabrook. There'll be another car here shortly. Tell them to come and find us.
He and Marie ran along the side of the big old warehouse, looking for a way in.
This place is huge, yelled Marie, loping along ahead of him. Where's the main entrance?
They turned a corner and came upon the remains of what must have been the driveway into the factory. It was overgrown and littered with junk, a graveyard for dumped factory equipment and rusting old vehicles.
This way, Marie called out. There are big double doors.
He caught her up.
And it's been opened recently?
They made out scuffs and footmarks through the mud and the weeds that had grown up around the doors. He put his shoulder to one of them, but it held firm.
Locked. Damn it.
Hang on.
Marie pointed to a narrow personnel door located a little further along.
Try this one.
It caved in on the second attempt, and Jackman almost fell through into a big open foyer. The stench of damp hit them. They saw at once that the place was treacherous.
Tread carefully, Marie. This is a death trap.
He glanced at the main doors, but there was no key. Whoever had used the door had locked it and taken the key with them. They stood for a moment listening, wondering where to start first.
I hate to say this.
Marie nodded towards a rickety staircase. But knowing his M.O., the only way is up. She was right.
Just be very careful, Marie. No accidents out here, okay?
It was not easy. Several times he wondered how the magician could have manhandled his victim up these hazardous steps, but the footprints and drag marks told Jackman he had. Someone had been here recently, and he was pretty sure it wasn't a group of explorers.
There's one more floor.
Marie had stopped to work out the next stage of the ascent. As she did so, they heard a sound.
They stopped still and listened.
That's no Jack Russell, whispered Marie.
God, no, it isn't.
Jackman passed her and ran up the final stairs with Marie at his heels. He knew what he was going to find, but it was still a shock when he stared upwards and saw the figure of Crazy Hazy swinging slowly in the half-light above.
Ring it in. Ambulance, Marie, now.
Jackman leapt forward to where the loose end of the rope had been secured and started to untie the knots, cursing as he fumbled. The knots started to give, and he braced himself to take the dead weight of Keith Hazel as he began to gently lower him from the rafters.
On their way, and a police crew are here already, on the stairs from the sound of it.
Marie positioned herself beneath the hanged man, ready to ease him down to the floor without injuring him further. She was trying to avoid looking at the lad's face, and Jackman didn't blame her. He swallowed hard. From the look of him, they might just have got to him before he died, but he wasn't sure how much of a life the kid would have left.
"We've got you, Keith. We've got you. Hold on in there. You're safe now."
He wondered if this was really true. He'd had a brief look at the young man's eyes and recalled Rory's words about pressure building up. He doubted that Keith could see them at all. Two police constables rushed in. One ran to assist Marie, and the other helped Jackman with the rope.
"He's down," Marie gasped as she eased him onto his side. "But, oh, Jackman, he's in a very bad way."
Jackman pulled out his phone and asked to be connected with ambulance control. "I need to know what to do to help him," he yelled, "or we're going to lose him." It turned out there was little they could do, other than try to keep him warm and leave him in the recovery position. Keith needed professional help, not first aid. The next 15 minutes were a nightmare of uncertainty. Then, finally, the ambulance was blue-lighting Keith Hazel to Greenborough. Jackman and Marie watched it go, flying down the long straight drive to the main road.
"Poor kid," she said in a hushed voice. "I really don't fancy his chances, do you?"
"From what the prof told me earlier, no, I don't."
He straightened up. "Well, we'd better get going. We will have to get forensics out, again.
Rory's going to love us, but at least he doesn't have to cut anyone down this time."
Marie looked down and wrinkled her nose.
"Talking of which, I need a shower and a change of clothes. Crazy Hazy was in a bit of a mess, wasn't he?"
That's not your new perfume, then. Look, take my car. I'll wait here and do what has to be done. Uniform can drop me back. It'll be a good while before I get it all organized."
She took his keys from him. "Okay, I'll bring Ruth up to speed, shall I?"
"Please, Marie, and get the others organized. I'll keep in touch."
"Any plastic bags in your car, sir?" she asked hopefully.
"In the boot, there's a roll of them."
"Good." She took off her jacket and rolled it up. "This took the worst. I'll bag it and boot it and sit on another bag so I won't mess up your car." He smiled.
"It's had worse in it. Not much, I admit. Now, off you go."
Just as she was about to leave, she pointed to the patrol car. "Seems we're using a new breed of police dog these days." There, curled up on the front seat, lay a small Jack Russell. Jackman laughed.
"Iggy, I presume."
"I'll tell Mrs. Seabrook that he's in police custody. See you later."
He watched her go, wondering if Keith Hazel had been the last on the list. Would they have to go through this again and again before they caught the magician? It was a depressing thought. Chapter 31 Marie showered at the station. She always kept a change of clothes in her locker, so she was soon good to go again. She notified the super, and then returned to the CID room, where Gary was waiting for her.
"Sarge, I've just heard from John about that airfield. Can I talk to you somewhere in private?"
Marie nodded.
"The boss won't mind if we nick his office for 5 minutes. He's tied up out at the P house."
"I heard you managed to get that young explorer down just in time."
She sighed. "I'm not sure if he'll make it, Gary. God knows how long he'd been up there. You should have seen the state of him, poor little sod."
They went into the office.
"I'm sorry you had to see it, Marie, but thank heavens you got there when you did. He might just have saved his life. He's young, and the young can be remarkably resilient."
Marie shrugged.
"Okay, the airfield."
"The main thing, Marie, is that it's not what we thought, and I'm certain it has nothing to do with the magician. It must have been pure bad luck that they chose the airfield, but it stirred up all sorts of problems."
They sat down at Jackman's magnificent desk.
"There is a secret to that place, but it's a very old one. Very old indeed."
"Get on with it, Gary," he chuckled.
"John, as it happens, got on very well with Sidney, and so the old man decided to tell him his story. He swore John to secrecy."
"And? Patience isn't my strongest point, Gary Pritchard, and it's wearing dangerously thin."
He flashed her a wicked grin.
"It was an RAF base, and the story involves an aircraft that crashed there just towards the end of the war.
old Sidney was a farmhand working the land when it came down, and he... There was a loud rap at the door. It was Berry Hopkins, the office manager.
Sergeant Evans, Professor Rory Wilkinson on your desk phone. Says it's urgent.
Damn. Stay right where you are, Gary. Murray hurried out.
My dear Sergeant, good news for once. We have DNA. That debacle at the control tower finally yielded some evidence. Your killer was in a hurry. No doubt thrown by the appearance of the gorgeous D.I. Jackman and that lovely young detective he had in tow. At some point, your man cut himself. Not surprising, as the place was knee-deep in broken glass. He got some blood on the Asquith lad's clothing. Result, you find me a suspect, and I have a beautiful double helix belonging solely to your killer.
So, I take it you found no matches on our system, she said.
None, but at least we do have admissible evidence. Come on, Sergeant, I expect rounds of applause.
Murray smiled. Sorry, I'm thrilled, I really am.
All right then, but I'm not sure if you deserve the second bit of news.
There's more.
Cardiff just called from that P warehouse. She'd only been there 10 minutes and she found something. She's such an asset, that one. I'm so pleased she's going to stay.
What is it with people today? Murray thought. Why can't they just say what they have to say?
Yes, I'm sure she is, Rory, and... Oh, yes, well, your lovely inspector noticed that this magician person had put a lot of care and attention into getting everything right when he hung up that last victim.
Cardiff put up an extending ladder and found that he had sanded down the rafter to allow the rope to slide over easily. She found 2 perfect prints.
That's brilliant.
Good. That's the reaction I hoped for.
Oh, and wood is wonderful for fingerprints. Being porous, it preserves the prints so much better than a man-made surface. Evidently, he either didn't think we'd bother to check right up in the rafters, or he believed that we'd just pull the rope down and check that. Whatever, he didn't put on those cursed gloves, and he reckoned without the intrepid Cardiff.
This is the best news we've had, Rory. Have you told Jackman? She asked.
Cardiff passed on the good news. Now, I'll have the prints very soon. Shall we check them, or would you like that happy task?
I'll take them directly to Orac as soon as you have them, Rory, so IT can check for a match.
Fine by me. I'll call you as soon as I have them. The good thing about patent prints over latent ones, that is, visible rather than invisible, is that you can collect them using photography. We might need to improve the quality of the images, but it's a simple process, and in any case, we probably won't need it.
She thanked him again and hung up. Would the killer be on the system? Could they be that lucky? Things were finally beginning to look better. She turned away, but her phone rang again. She picked it up, expecting Jackman. But it was Orac.
We need to talk, Murray.
Have you got a link for us? So soon? Asked Murray incredulously.
I have, some thoughts, shall we say. Can you come down?
On my way, Orac. All the way down the stairs, Marie kept jumping from one supposition to another. The airfield? The magician? And why had Orac sounded so troubled?
Marie broke into a run.
Orac appeared distracted and anxious. You haven't had bad news, have you? Marie asked. Your sister?
No, nothing like that, Orac said dismissively.
It's where this search is going. I don't like it. I need more time. Because this is something I dare not second-guess or make assumptions about. But I think that by this evening at the latest, I'll be able to tell you what links these deaths. Will you promise to wait at the station until you've heard from me?
Marie frowned, puzzled. Orac had spoken with such urgency. She agreed to stay around.
Thank you. I think your Alfie Brown is going to be able to fill in 1 or 2 gaps in my data. You said you were interviewing him. Is he still here?
I'm not sure. Robbie was the one meeting him. I'll ask.
I'd really like to talk to him, said Orac. As soon as possible.
Marie called Robbie.
Marie, where are you?
He sounded puzzled.
I'm down in IT. Tell me, did you bring Alfie Brown to the station to interview him? Is he still here? Orac needs to talk to him.
Yeah, Robbie said. I thought he was safest, all things considered. He's downstairs. But to be honest, Marie, he's not the best person to get anything out of. Poor guy is pretty frightened. He's convinced that the magician is coming for him and he doesn't feel safe even here.
Could you bring him down to IT, Rob? He might be of some help to Orac.
She ended the call.
Robbie is bringing him now. Is there anything I can do?
Not yet, Marie. Just give me a little more time, okay? You can leave Alfie with me and I'll ring up when we're finished. This could take a while.
Marie frowned.
You really think he can provide the information we need?
I'm sure of it.
When Alfie Brown arrived, Marie understood what Robbie had meant. The young man was a bundle of nerves, almost incapable of standing or sitting still. Oddly, he seemed to take to Aurak, and after a few minutes she indicated for Marie and Robbie to leave.
I'm not sure that this is correct procedure, said Robbie,
but already Aurak seems to be getting on a whole lot better than me.
Don't worry about procedure. She'll let us know when she's through and we can collect him.
Marie decided not to say more. Aurak had said she would tell her specifically, so she would wait for her call. Once back upstairs, she looked around for Gary, hoping to hear more about the airfield mystery, but he was nowhere to be seen. She called across to the office manager.
Barry, where's Gary?
He said he was popping out for a while, Sarge, but wouldn't be long.
Marie sighed. Once again, the airfield would have to wait, which was a shame because she needed a distraction to stop her worrying about what Aurak might have found. From the way she looked, she had discovered something really bad. Still out of the P-House, Jackman was just about to hand over to uniform when his mobile rang. It was Laura. He still felt a little start of pleasure when he saw her name on his screen.
Hello, sweetheart. I just thought I'd let you know that I still haven't been able to talk to Callie Protheroe.
Jackman stiffened. This wasn't what he wanted to hear.
That's worrying.
Henry seemed quite distressed, actually. He said he was wondering if she was reacting badly to the drugs the hospital prescribed. He was thinking of taking her back and getting her checked over. It is possible. Some people react badly to sedatives.
So, she was still sleeping?
More or less, said Laura. He told me he had taken her a cup of tea and asked her to ring me. But she seemed too lethargic to even make the call. I recommended that she stop taking the tablets and that he phone the hospital and talk to someone about them. I also reminded him that shock can have a delayed effect. Some people just want to sleep all the time to block out their memories.
Sounds like good advice, he paused. He didn't give you any cause for concern, did he, Laura? As in, that he was lying to you?
Not at all. Why, darling, what are you thinking?
He wasn't sure, and he wasn't sure of Henry Arnott. Either the man was exactly what he seemed, perfectly genuine and in love with Callie, as Marie had suggested, or he was a bloody good liar.
Probably nothing, but it worries me that we haven't made actual contact with Callie herself.
Shall I call round when I finish here?
Laura asked.
No, absolutely not, Laura. If anyone's going, it'll be me. I'm honestly not sure about that man, and I don't want you going anywhere near him on your own.
That was a bit forceful, my love. She sounded rather amused. But I appreciate what you're saying, so I'll stick to ringing up. Don't worry.
I mean it, Laura. He's still a suspect. Not high on our list, I admit. But he just bothers me.
I hear you, Jackman. Honestly, I won't be making any house calls, I promise.
Jackman ended the call and rang Marie to say he was on his way back. She sounded preoccupied but promised to fill him in on his return. Hearing that did nothing to ease his growing apprehension. He sensed a mounting tension. He'd felt it before, and it always heralded some crisis in a case. It wasn't until around 8:30 in the evening that Aurak called. An uncle had collected Alfie Brown and taken him to stay with him for a while, as the young man had flatly refused to go back home. Everyone else had left except Robbie, who, having kicked this case off in the first place, felt obliged to see it through. All three of them went down to the basement and found Aurak alone. She sat with her hands together, as if in prayer. She looked terrible.
The first thing I have to tell you is that there's another victim. It isn't Alfie Brown, as he supposed, but his cousin, Stevie Brown, another urban explorer.
Jackman sat rigid, waiting for what was to come.
I have his address, and I know you'll get someone straight round there, but I suspect your killer has already abducted him.
She spoke in a monotone, flat and emotionless.
He is the last. There will be no more deaths at this man's hand.
Then we have to find this Stevie and make sure he doesn't become the final victim, Robbie said.
You will, D.C. Melton.
She handed him the address. Get your colleagues round there by all means, but then I have to tell you,
what I've discovered. She looked from one to the other. Please, just sit down and listen.
Marie could sense Robbie's impatience, so she sent him outside to ring uniform. As soon as he was back, they all pulled up chairs and waited.
After I returned and began working on this investigation, I started to think about my quest to find my sister, and some questions arose. The timing, for one thing. You needed my help, and I wasn't here, and I felt bad about that.
She smiled ruefully at Marie.
But that wasn't even the half of it.
She stared down at her hands now folded in her lap.
To my shame, I was stupid enough to be lured out of the country. I was effectively removed from here because these killings could not have taken place if I had been part of the investigation.
Marie let out a long sigh.
I really hope it's not what I'm thinking.
Orak met her gaze.
It probably is. When I saw the forensic photos of the young men's bodies in situ, I knew they were the key to the whole thing, but it wasn't until I managed to find what bound the victims together that I knew for sure.
You know who the magician is?
Jackman leaned forward.
Orak, if you do, we have to get out there and find him.
My dear Inspector, I can most likely tell you exactly where you'll find him, if you will just allow me a few more minutes. I can save you rushing around and getting nowhere, she faltered, even if doing so will break my heart.
Marie's heart went out to Orak.
It's Dara, isn't it? Can you tell us why? Why is he doing this?
Orak's sigh seemed to come from her very soul.
Yes, Dara. My dear friend. My partner. The man who not only saved my life, but traced my sister for me. You see, his only son died while exploring an abandoned building. I've only just found the details because Dara has never spoken about his boy's death. His name was Lars, which I did know. He had become addicted to urban exploration.
He went out, alone one night, fell through a high ceiling and got his left foot trapped.
He died, suspended upside down, but remained undiscovered for several days because he hadn't told anyone where he was going.
So his father is targeting other urban explorers?
Asked Robbie, wide-eyed.
5 young men, who were a major influence on Lars and led to his becoming such an avid explorer. I believe that Dara blames them for his son's horrific death, and he's made them pay. Sackcloth and ashes, in penitence for their part in his boy's death.
Jackman let out a long, low breath.
But this Dara is a silent hero who fought undercover for his country. You knew him so well, you trusted him. How did he turn into a killer?
Love, Inspector Jackman. That's the answer to your question.
Orak looked at him sadly.
Suppose you had a precious son or daughter. Just think about it. Dara and I lived life on the edge. We both saw insanity on a grand scale while we did the work that we did. And never forget, we were trained to kill. It was part of your life. But we all have a breaking point, Inspector, and Dara is only human, albeit a broken one.
From Jackman's expression, Marie saw that he was weighing up a murderer who tortured and killed young men, with a hero who had saved Orak's life. She knew he understood in part as she did, but there was no forgetting what he had done. Marie had nothing but admiration for Orak. This must be tearing her apart. She would have laid down her life for him, and yet she was handing him over to the police because that was the right thing to do. Marie held out her hand to Orak.
What you've told us took great courage.
Orak took her hand and squeezed it tightly. She let it go and took a deep, shaky breath.
Now to the facts. She swallowed and picked up a sheaf of printouts. Some of this I accessed using searches already collated by Philip and Leon, along with some of my own.
I also have information from the coroner's report on the death by misadventures of Lars Peter Quinnell, Quinnell being one of the names Dara took after leaving the job. I always knew him as Dara Quinn. Other facts come from my personal knowledge of Dara himself. For instance, his training taught him how to carry a wounded comrade out of the line of fire and to safety, meaning that he could easily have carried those explorers back to his car. He was always strong and very agile.
Did the military teach him those pressure point techniques too?
Asked Jackman.
Not to my knowledge. It wasn't used in basic training. But I've seen him use them,
and I know he's capable of felling someone in an instant. I saw a man drop like a stone once, giving us a chance to get away from a bad situation.
Did he practice martial arts, Orak?
Asked Marie, thinking of what her black belt friend from the Kuksul Wan Dojang had told her.
She nodded. He did. Well, we both did, but he was way ahead of me. And he meditated a lot. He had a deeply spiritual side.
This was hard to equate with the horror Marie had witnessed in the bell tower on Hallow's Fen, but she wasn't going to contradict Orak.
Dara must have found the names of Lars Urbeck's friends, those he blamed for his son's death, from a log that Lars kept on his computer, along with hundreds of photographs. This electronic diary was mentioned at the inquest because they were trying to ascertain whether he had gone out alone or with others. One of his friends, Stevie Brown, was present at the coroner's court as a witness. He admitted that it had been he who got Lars into urban exploration in the first place, and he was proud of the fact that Lars had become such an enthusiastic explorer. He said he was very good at it, and usually very careful. He was shocked when he discovered that Lars had gone out alone, and even more surprised that he had told no one where he was going. He said it was totally out of character, and he could only imagine that he'd done it in response to a dare from another explorer.
A very costly dare, murmured Jackman.
Indeed, said Orak quietly. I found photographs. Look. She handed them a couple of images of a good-looking young man, with longish fair hair, a slightly crooked nose, and a ready smile.
Lars.
He wasn't yet 21 when he died.
So sad,
Marie said softly.
Jackman handed her back the photographs.
Orak. Where is he going to take this Stevie Brown?
She looked at him, her lenses masking all expression.
Back to where Lars died? How do you know?
Asked Robbie.
Because I know Dara. It would be a fitting end to it all. Dara likes things to be properly done, no loose ends. He's obsessive like that.
The laundered clothes delivered to Rory Wilkinson, mused Jackman, like the belongings of a fallen soldier being sent home.
Only he knew they'd be classed as evidence, so he sent them direct to the Home Office pathologist. No drama, no fuss, added Marie.
We should get organized, sir, said Robbie urgently. The magician, Dara Quinn, could be on his way already.
Orak shook her head. I don't think so, Officer Melton. I took the liberty of ringing Professor Wilkinson and asked if it was possible that all the victims were hanged at or near a specific time. He agrees that it's more than likely that each victim was actually strung up at around midnight. She paused. The approximate time Lars fell through the ceiling.
Dara will be that specific? Queried Jackman.
Without a doubt, said Orak.
Where is this place?
Asked Marie.
The old airfield at Randleby, in the ruin of the control tower.
Marie gasped in disbelief.
But we were assured that Randleby has no connection with this case.
I beg to differ. It has everything to do with it, Orak stated. It was the beginning of this whole thing, and was to be the end of it.
But we checked the history of Randleby, Robbie's voice rose. We've scoured every newspaper, every online site, every bit of local history, and even talked to the local police at Fenchester. There has been no mention whatsoever of a boy ever dying there.
You're quite right, Orak said, because the government issued a gagging order restricting the broadcasting of any information pertaining to Lars Quinnell's death.
Ah, the old secret, whispered Marie, whatever that is.
It isn't connected to Dara, Marie. Orak looked at her. I'll be able to tell you more about that later, but for legal reasons the location of the body was kept secret.
So what the hell was so important about that miserable plot of land? Marie desperately wanted to know. She would just have to wait. They might have up to 3 hours to organize a massive operation if they were to save Stevie Brown. She glanced at Jackman, and he nodded slightly.
We have work to do, Orak. We can't assume he'll wait. We have to get there as soon as possible.
He smiled sadly at her.
Thank you. Your decision must have come at a tremendous cost to you. But if it's any consolation, you've done the right thing.
Then why does it feel as if I've stabbed my best friend in the back?
You couldn't have lived with the alternative, Orak.
Marie laid a hand on her shoulder.
It's just not in you to allow a young man to die, or for the loved ones of those other innocent young men to have no closure.
Orak sighed.
Do you know what the final nail in the coffin was?
Marie shook her head.
The Book of Kells.
He told me he was in Dublin, and he was going to Trinity College Library because he'd never seen the manuscript.
He forgot, Marie. I have a very good memory. He saw it years ago.
Orak stood up.
I'm going to ask one favor, Jackman.
I want to come with you. I need to talk to him. Jackman opened his mouth, apparently about to protest, then stopped. All right. But we have to go, now. Orak swallowed and muttered her thanks. Jackman hurried out. Marie waited while Orak went to her locker and retrieved her jacket.
Okay, my friend. Let's go.
Chapter 32 Jackman had warned Ruth Crook that there might be a breakthrough that evening regarding the magician case, and she had decided to work on in her office and wait. In preparation, she had alerted Uniform to the possibility of an incident, so as soon as he had notified her, she set the wheels in motion. Now that they knew the killer was ex-military, she also asked for an armed tactical unit to be on standby in case of a possible situation involving firearms. It was decided to get to Randleby as speedily as possible, and to conceal themselves in the hangars and stores. They would take down Dara Quinn and secure his hostage before he could get into the old control tower building. They were fully aware that this would be no easy feat given Quinn's background, but Jackman was pretty certain that he wouldn't want to deliberately injure any innocent police officers. As soon as Ruth Crook was given the location, she passed the information up the chain and requested someone who had knowledge of Randleby Airfield to make quite sure that they were not hindered in any way. A man's life could be jeopardized if this happened. Assured of a clear passage, the operation was to go ahead as planned. Robbie, Ruth, and the uniformed operation commander traveled in one vehicle, along with a trained negotiator, while Marie and Orak rode with Jackman. The journey passed in silence. Jackman could only imagine what was going through Orak's mind. He first realized that something wasn't right when they approached the perimeters of the airfield and found the gates unlocked and wide open. Then he saw a big 4x4 parked on a flat expanse of hard standing between one of the hangars and the battered remains of the control tower. There had been no attempt to conceal the vehicle.
"I was wrong," breathed Orak. "He came early." This changed everything.
Jackman's radio broke into his thoughts. It was Ruth, wanting to talk to him immediately. He jumped from the car and raced back to Ruth's vehicle.
"Do we know if he's armed?" she asked.
"No, but Orak said he rarely carried or used a gun even when working. He preferred other methods. Now she's certain that his only interest is in the 5 young men who led his son into the pastime that killed him." She turned to the uniformed superintendent beside her. "We need a situation report on exactly who is in that airfield and where they are." He nodded. "We'll surround the main area, and I'll have teams check out the 2 nearest hangars in the control tower. That place is dangerous. It's little more than a ruin, so we need to take great care in there."
"You need to take great care, full stop," added Jackman. "Quinn was a highly trained professional. He could be armed, and we have no idea about his mental state."
"He's killed 3 men, critically injured another and abducted a 5th. I would suggest that his mental health isn't up to much," Ruth said bitterly.
"That goes without saying, Super. I was thinking more of how he'll react when he sees a police cordon around the place where his son died."
This was a bit strong, but she took it well.
"Dear Jackman is right. Tell your officers that this is a delicate situation and not to underestimate Quinn at any cost."
Superintendent Fuller nodded.
"I've briefed them already. They are all aware that this is a possibly volatile situation. Now, I need to get this moving, especially if there's someone at risk in there."
He left the vehicle and gathered his officers together. Soon, one by one, they peeled off from the assembly and slipped through the gates. Jackman, Ruth, and Robbie returned to his car. They waited, silent, tense. Suddenly, Orak's phone vibrated. She pressed the speaker button, and they listened.
"Oh, Kira, why didn't you stay in Ireland and let me finish this? You should have just gone to Dublin, like I asked. And why didn't you talk to me before you started all this, Dara?
I was your closest friend. I would have helped you.
It was too late for that, Kira. And don't use the past tense. You still are my closest friend. I don't blame you for any of this. I know you too well, and that's why I spent months scouring Ireland to find your sister for you. All I needed was for you to be gone for a week, so I could complete my mission. You were never in Dublin, were you? You were here, hunting those young men?
I would have joined you afterwards, I swear. But you came home.
Dara Quinn sounded frighteningly calm, considering that he must have seen that he was surrounded by police officers.
Ask him about Stevie,
Jackman whispered urgently. He had to know if the young man was dead or alive. It would make a difference to how the situation was handled.
Where are you, Dara?
Orak asked. Are you alone? He laughed, a short bark.
You know exactly where I am, my dear friend. And no, I'm not alone.
Another little laugh.
Although my companion isn't very good company right now.
Have you killed him too, Dara? Asked Orak, her tone even.
Let's say the process has begun, albeit a little ahead of time. I knew that as soon as you made the connection, you and your friends would be here en masse. Sadly, I was forced to bring it forward.
That meant that Stevie Brown was now suspended by 1 foot, high up in a dangerous building. But he wasn't dead, unless Quinn had completely changed his methods. Jackman needed to cling to that supposition.
So come down, Dara. Please. I desperately need to talk to you,
Orak pleaded.
For the sake of everything we went through, I need to see you.
Then you come up here to me, Kira. I won't hurt you. You know that.
If you want to talk, that's the only way it can happen.
Orak stared up at the ruined control tower.
Okay, I'll come.
She ended the call. Jackman grasped her arm.
No, you can't.
She turned those disconcerting eyes on him.
I have to. He won't hurt me, I know it.
You thought he'd wait until midnight, but he didn't, Jackman said urgently. You can't afford to be wrong about this, too.
I'm not.
That was just a simple change of plan, not a change of heart.
Dar would never, ever hurt me.
I can't allow you to do this, Orak.
Gently she took his fingers and released them one by one.
You mean well, and I know you're thinking of my safety, but the only way he'll come down from up there is if he's carried down. Dead. I have to see him before it's too late. Jackman, I'd be blind if it weren't for him. He saved my life more than once. I don't for one moment condone what he's done, but neither can I rewrite the past. He was a brave man and a loyal friend. And I have to say goodbye. I have to.
The silence that followed her words seemed interminable, until Jackman said,
Then we come too, and that's final. If you go, we go. And if he as much as breathes on you, Ruth has an armed tactical unit standing by. I'd be prepared to swear I thought he had a gun.
She didn't respond. Instead, she pushed her phone back into her pocket and began to walk towards the gates.
He'll be up there.
She pointed to the highest point of the derelict tower. Jackman turned to Ruth.
Can you get some lights on this place? I'll go with her and take Marie.
Robbie and the negotiator can follow, with a couple of uniformed officers.
He didn't wait for a reply, but turned to Robbie.
I want you to hang back, and if there is the slightest indication that he has a firearm, call Ruth immediately.
And I'll activate the tactical unit.
Ruth's face held unusual warmth and concern.
You take care. I want you all back safely, understand?
Jackman looked up at the crumbling ruin and took a deep breath.
We'll be back, Ruth.
He turned to Marie.
Ready?
Ready.
With Jackman leading the way, they were almost at the entrance when Marie noticed that Orak was struggling. She took her arm.
What's the problem?
Partial night blindness, Orak said in a clipped, matter-of-fact manner.
Okay, I'll get ahead of you. Keep hold of my jacket.
After this, they made good progress across the rubble-strewn area. Soon they were at the outer door, and just as Jackman pushed it open, the control tower was illuminated. The bright white light of the halogen lamps made everything look unreal.
She seemed to have stepped into some strange other world, the light too bright, and the shadow too black.
This way.
Jackman had the beam of his powerful torch directed towards a concrete stairwell. The ground floor was more or less intact, although filthy, littered with broken glass, pieces of crumbling brick and plaster, and the twisted metal from some old window frames.
Marie suspected that the first and second floors would have been worst affected by the passage of time and the constant winds off the sea.
She was soon proved right. As they emerged onto the next floor, they all stopped. A blast of cold night air signaled that one corner had gone completely.
"Okay, everyone," Jackman called back. "Take great care from now on. Watch every step. The stairs are covered in crap, so tread warily."
The temporary lights set up by uniform were penetrating deeper inside the collapsed part of the old building. It made moving forward easier, but also created areas of dense blackness that intensified the surreal, almost cinematic effect. Marie kept a close eye on Orak. She was clearly unhappy in this odd half-dark, half-brilliant glare, but she moved on, doggedly. Finally, they stepped out onto the third floor. It resembled the pictures she'd seen of bombed-out buildings after the war. One whole wall had disappeared, and part of the second had crumbled into heaps of rubble. They stood and gazed around them, trying to take in where they were, and more to the point, where were Dara Quinn and his hostage.
Then they did see him, and they all gasped.
Quinn was lit up by the outside lights as if in the spotlight of some theatrical production. Above them were the skeletal remains of part of the metal framework of the observation gallery on the very top of the tower. Most of the ceiling had collapsed, although some rafters, joists, and platform-like areas remained. Dara Quinn was perched high up, sitting on a wooden beam that was still attached to one of the existing walls. He sat quite still, and Marie noted that he was holding a length of rope, tightly wound, around one hand.
Nothing moved, with one exception.
To Quinn's left, suspended by his left ankle and securely attached at the other end of the rope, was the gagged and writhing body of Stevie Brown. The rope, passed over an exposed roof joist, was not tied off or secured. Quinn had looped it through a piece of metal bracket, but it was only held fast by his own hand. Marie looked down and saw that the hanged man had been positioned over a gaping hole that went straight down to the ground floor.
If Dara did release his grip, Stevie Brown would fall head first down the three floors onto concrete.
No one spoke. The only sound, other than the faint whistle of the wind, were the muffled cries of Dara Quinn's final victim. Jackman turned and held out his hand to Orak. He stepped back beside Marie and whispered to her,
"This is her time. Ours comes immediately afterwards."
Marie nodded, but kept within reach of Orak, should her impaired vision cause her to make a wrong move in this strange light. For a time, she and Quinn stared at each other in silence. Then Orak said,
"Grania, did you only look for her in order to get me out of England?"
A soft sigh wafted down to them.
"No, Kira. I've been trying to find your sister for years. I've made countless trips to Ireland, all fruitless, until recently. It wasn't until I realized what I had to do for my son that it suddenly came to me that it would be best that you weren't around for a while." He paused. "The timing couldn't have been better. I'd just managed to trace Grania, or Louisa Kennedy as she is now. But there were a few last pieces of the jigsaw to put in place. I left those for you. I thought it was fitting that you actually discovered her for yourself." Another pause. "It was to be my parting gift to you, with love."
Marie was having difficulty connecting the use of the word love with those horrific deaths.
"Thank you," Orak whispered. "I will always be grateful to you for that, as I will for everything you did for me in the past. But Dara, you can't kill that boy. You just can't." "I have to. I promised Lars." "Your son died in a tragic accident, doing something he enjoyed. No one forced him to become an explorer. He loved it. This young man shouldn't die because your son made a terrible mistake in going out alone. Please, Dara, tie off that rope and come down.
This isn't how I want our friendship to end.
The conversation moved back and forth, with neither party backing down. Marie sensed Robbie hovering at the top of the stairwell behind her. She took a careful step back to get within earshot.
Robbie, she hissed, get fire service quick. Get a safety net across the ground floor beneath that hole, now.
Robbie disappeared while Jackman nodded in approval. Marie just hoped that Trumpton could organize it fast. At any moment, Quinn could decide to release that rope. Orak began begging Quinn to free the boy. Marie's eyes moved to the gagged figure swinging above her, wondering how long he could hold on. It took a while before she realized that Orak had been very slowly edging towards a narrow stone staircase that led up to where Dara still sat on his rafter.
Orak, she whispered. No, stay where you are.
Orak paused for a few moments, eyeing the stairs, no doubt calculating her route up. At some time, they must have had a banister rail, but it had gone, and one side was completely open. The treads were no more than 18 inches wide, and in places they were chipped and worn, but worst of all, they went nowhere. They stopped just shy of the wooden rafter, after which there was nothing but empty space. Marie thought with horror of Orak's poor vision. Marie suddenly picked up a change in Quinn's voice. He was asking Orak to leave and to take the police with her. At that point, Jackman moved forward.
He'll not come down, Orak. It's time a professional negotiator spoke with him.
Orak remained silent, and as Jackman turned to beckon the trained officer to approach, she dived towards the stairs. Without thinking, Marie followed. She heard Quinn calling down, begging her to go back, but Orak climbed on. Marie was amazed at how fast Orak moved, despite her poor vision. She had to stop her. Marie was certain that Quinn intended to let Stevie fall, then throw himself down after him. And she was pretty sure that Orak knew it too. But was it Orak's intention to stop him, or join him?
Orak, cried Marie. Kira, stop, you can't do this. Think of your sister. Dara has given you your sister back, so accept his gift. Do as he asks, please.
There was nothing more she could do. Then, to her relief, Orak stopped climbing. Marie saw her shiver and hastened forward to hold her steady. Slowly, inch by inch, they edged back down the cracked and pitted stairs. Marie heard a voice above her whisper,
"Thank you."
She paused and looked up, but no one was there. In the days that followed, she often wondered if she had really heard the dull thud of Dara's body hitting the concrete hard standing, or if she had just imagined it. The second they were back on solid ground, Jackman dashed past her and started up the stairs.
"Go careful, sir," she yelled after him. "They're treacherous."
"He hasn't secured that rope properly," Jackman shouted back. "And I don't know if your safety net is in place yet. If that kid doesn't stop flailing around, the rope will give."
She shouted at the panic-stricken Stevie Brown.
"Keep calm. Keep as still as you can, Stevie. Help is on its way. Stay still, for God's sake."
Miraculously, he responded. He stopped kicking and managed to steady the rope.
"Good man. Just stay like that for a bit longer."
Jackman had almost made it to the rafter when Stevie renewed his struggles, and this time, the rope came loose. Stevie Brown plummeted towards the ground. Marie felt the draft as he fell.
"No!"
screamed Jackman. There was a long moment of silence, and then she heard voices drifting up to them from two floors below.
"We've got him. He's safe."
Marie brushed away tears and turned her attention to Jackman, who was trying to pick his way down to where she and Orak stood waiting. At one point he slipped, gasped, and then regained his balance. A shower of tiny pieces of stone cascaded down around them. Being bigger and heavier, Jackman's descent was hazardous in the extreme. At last, he was standing beside them.
"I'm so sorry, Orak," he said softly.
There was nothing more to say.
"Let's get you out of here," said Jackman to the grief-stricken woman. "Take with you the knowledge that you saved that young man's life."
When they reached the ground floor, Orak said,
"I want to go to him."
Marie and Jackman shared a look, and then in silence they walked around to where Dara lay.
Surrounded by a spreading pool of dark blood, one of his legs was twisted behind him unnaturally. Marie and Jackman stood back, allowing Orak to approach him alone. She sank down at his side, took his lifeless hand in hers, and began talking very softly. They turned away. A lump formed in Marie's throat and tears welled up in her eyes. Yes, he was a killer, and maybe it was for the best that he had ended his life. But he had risked his own life to save Orak and preserve her sight. He had pledged his life to his country and served it well, and his loyalty had damaged him beyond repair. Marie whispered, "It's sad, isn't it? The world will see him as a monster, and all the good he did, all his bravery, will be forgotten."
"Not by everyone."
Jackman nodded towards Orak. Maybe that was enough. Epilogue. Tonight, the Golden Compass at Randleby was playing host to a number of very diverse guests. Gary Pritchard, who had organized this occasion, had commandeered one of the two bars for the whole evening. When they had all eaten, he stood by the bar and tapped his glass for silence. "I thought it might be appropriate for us all to get together so we can hear the true story of the mystery of Randleby Airfield and what the future holds for it." Marie was sitting between her mother, Rhiannon, and D.S. Ralph Enderby. She was enjoying herself immensely. A years-long shroud of darkness had lifted, and life was looking good. The whole team were in attendance, plus Rory, accompanied by both Spike and Cardiff Erin. Robbie and Ella sat with Stella and her husband, Tom, and next to them were Will and Lisa Sheringham, along with several other Urbexes, including Ray Zakara and Emily Butters. Callie Prothero and Henry Arnott were with them. It turned out that Callie's oddly drugged demeanor had been caused by a bad reaction to the medication the hospital had prescribed her. Henry had taken her back and insisted they examine her thoroughly. Marie had been right all along. Henry truly did care for Callie, and judging by the way she kept touching him, she felt the same. Marie smiled to herself. Hopefully, it would serve to dampen Robbie Melton's ardor and bring his attention back to the beautiful Ella. A few people coughed, and silence fell over the assembly. Gary introduced his old friend, John Beard.
"I was told some of this story by an actual eyewitness," he began. "An old Fenlander now in his 90s, who is still as sharp as a tack. But first of all, you need to know a bit of Fen history to appreciate what I'm about to say."
You could have heard a pin drop in that bar.
"Because of our close proximity to Germany, our position on the east coast and with such flat terrain, Lincolnshire had more airfields than any other county in England. The majority of our Second World War bombers took off from here, and we became known as Bomber County. Most of you know this already, but what you might not know is that more aircraft also crashed here than anywhere else. It is thought that a couple of thousand aircraft came down in our fields."
This was an astounding figure, and there was a general murmur of surprise.
"The other thing that you might not realize is that some planes hit the ground at such speed that they completely buried themselves. The soil closed in on top of them, and the combination of oil, earth, and a lack of air preserved them like time capsules. Maybe 10% of the planes that crashed here are still beneath the ground."
"There's a memorial not far from where I live," said Ray Zakara.
"A Lancaster bomber is still under the field where the memorial was erected. It's the resting place of five men, I believe. I thought that was a one-off, a kind of fluke."
"Not at all," John said.
"I've contacted an aviation heritage centre, and they confirmed that there's a group of people who spend their free time hunting for these planes. Apparently, so long as they know that the crew all jumped, they get a license from the MOD to excavate the aircraft. They take them to museums and put them on show in aviation centres. They call themselves wreckologists, and are a recognised recovery group and a member of the British Aviation Archaeological Council."
"How did they know whether the crew bailed out?" asked Stella.
"Records. Even in wartime, they did their best to document those who died or who were presumed missing. The MOD rarely gives permission to excavate a site where they believe there are remains. Those are considered war graves. And then there is the Protection of Military Remains Act 1986.
And that's what happened here at Randleby?
Asked Robbie excitedly.
Absolutely, John smiled. And old Sidney Packer saw it come down. He says that by the time he got to the crash site, the field looked like a battleground. But there was no plane. He knew it was a German bomber, but it had just vanished. Then Sidney realized that a single airman had bailed out. He found him with his parachute tangled in a tree. With a few other farm hands, they cut him free and held him until a vehicle was dispatched from RAF Randleby to pick him up. Sidney said he'd heard of planes burying themselves, but had never actually seen it before then. He said it was the strangest thing he'd ever seen.
So why wasn't it common knowledge? Asked Marie. Why is Sidney Packer the only one who seems to know about it?
Because the military stepped in, chanced Jackman. Almost immediately, said John, and in a very short time, RAF Randleby ceased to exist. The locals were sworn to secrecy as a matter of national security, and as it was a time of war, they took it very seriously indeed. A lot of families were later relocated, leaving no one but Sidney to tell the tale. He wanted to get it off his chest before he died. He had heard that some of the restrictions were soon to be lifted, and some details were finally to be made public.
What details exactly? Rory looked enthralled. John looked across the room to where Superintendent Ruth Crook sat nursing a small dry sherry.
Would you do the honors, Superintendent?
Ruth stood up.
We all knew that there was a lot of clandestine activity taking place there, and we were definitely not made welcome when we asked permission to investigate the area, but there has been an official statement made. She cleared her throat. It has been acknowledged that a German Second World War bomber, a Dornier 17, crashed into the field adjoining the runway at Randleby. There was one survivor. As the other two crew members died in the aircraft, it was designated a war grave and was not to be disturbed. Their names were registered with the German authorities. After some tests, they have now estimated the depth at which the bomber is lying, and the field will once again be used for shallow planting. The rest of the airfield will be demolished, and the area will be cultivated as a wildlife park. Work is to begin immediately.
Ruth pursed her lips.
As you may realize, that is far from the whole story. The rest is unconfirmed, and I suggest that once heard, you consign the whole thing to the back burner.
All eyes were upon her, intrigued.
There are two rumors. The first is that there was a fourth man on that flight. Someone of very high standing who was delivering information vital to the war effort. If what he was carrying was ever dug up, or if it was known that he was heading for England, it could have meant a disaster for our campaign and later may have given rise to questions that the MOD preferred not to answer. So, RAF Randleby was effectively erased.
Surely any paperwork would have decayed over time, said Kevin Stoner.
Strangely, Rory said, a lot of paperwork has been found intact after years underground. I've been told that when airmen bailed out, they purposely left all paperwork behind, believing it would be destroyed on impact. Mostly it was, but if a plane did, as John here described, I can well believe that everything inside could have been preserved. The second rumour, continued Ruth, is that the fourth man was an eminent scientist who was defecting, and that he was carrying other important documents.
I'd have thought they could have dug it up and disposed of all the evidence, no matter which of those two scenarios was true, suggested Max.
There was a war on, son. It was chaos, John shrugged. But there were still regulations to follow. It was easier to cover it up and allow the world to forget.
John's story over, the company chattered amongst themselves. Ralph turned to Marie. I've got a bit of news that might interest you. She noticed the sparkle in his eyes and wondered what was coming. A friend of mine who runs a site clearance company has been hired by the MOD to clear the existing structures and haul it all out for disposal. He smiled at her. He's given me a certain time when one of his trucks will be pulling in to a lay-by for a short break. Should you happen to be there and just happen to have a trailer with you, a certain old motorcycle might accidentally fall off the back of said lorry. He winked at her. You wicked man. How did you arrange that? Marie almost jumped up and down. I'd given up on that old bike. Now I'll be able to get it restored. She leaned forward and kissed his cheek. I love you.
For a moment there was an odd look in his eyes. Then he seemed to recover himself.
It was worth the 50 quid then.
She hugged him. Jackman gave her a quizzical look.
"Doesn't have anything to do with a certain Norton, does it?"
he asked.
"I haven't seen you look so elated since they locked up Alistair Ashcroft."
"Can't say," she replied. "Military secret, you know." Jackman came over and sat with them.
"So, it's all over at last." He looked serious for a moment. "Before we came out tonight, I heard that Stevie Brown is none the worse for his horrible experience. He has some ankle problems, and mentally he's pretty stressed out, but hopefully it's nothing permanent."
"And the other lad? The one you saved after hours of being hanged upside down?" asked Ralph. "Did he survive?"
"It will be a long haul, and there's no guarantee he will make it, Ralph. He had brain hemorrhages and what they hope is temporary loss of vision, so it's too early to say."
"Poor kid. What did Quinn accuse him of?"
"Putting pressure on Lars to go out exploring on a regular basis. That's all we can think of. Like the other Urbexes. They either encouraged him, befriended him, or fired him up to do more and more extreme exploring. Nothing that any other kid wouldn't have done on finding another like-minded soul. Such a terrible waste."
"And a waste of his own life, too," thought Marie, her earlier effervescence evaporating. Aurak wasn't here. Marie hadn't expected her to be. She'd already explored the mystery of Randleby on her computer, and was certainly not up for an evening with a bunch of excited coppers and explorers. They had talked several times, once about the fact that Dara Quinn had been staying in Heron Court, in a flat close to Aurak's, for the whole time he was carrying out his killings. But mostly they talked about Aurak's sister and what she should do. She still wasn't 100% certain, but she was drafting that letter to leave with Grania's solicitor. It was good enough for now. The only thing that worried Marie was that Aurak seemed to be slipping back into a private world of her own, and she hoped it wouldn't end with her shutting Marie out. They had developed a bond over these past few weeks, and Marie hoped it would be a lasting one. It was early days, of course, and Aurak was still grieving, but Marie was watching out for her, and would continue to do so. Aurak had so few friends, and this particular one was determined to be there for her, no matter what. Her upbeat mood began to return. Her mother was beaming at her, winking towards Ralph, and giving her a thumbs up. Marie threw Rhiannon a mock frown, and then burst into laughter. From the moment they consigned Alistair Ashcroft to prison for life, Marie had started to feel free. The feeling was growing. There would be other terrible cases, because that was what her job was all about. But right now, looking around and seeing the people she loved and cared about all enjoying themselves, Marie Evans felt bloody good. The End. This has been an Audible Studios production of They Disappeared, written by Joy Ellis, performed by Richard Armitage, directed by John Ainsworth. Copyright by Joy Ellis 2020. Production copyright 2020 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.